This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss the escalating war in the Middle East, the ongoing devastation in Gaza, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's eighth visit to the White House. Joining us is Akbar Ahed Ahmed Shahid. He covers U.S. foreign policy for Not Us, News of the United States. He's author of the forthcoming book, Crossing the Red Line, Biden, His Advisors, and Israel's War in Gaza. For his Gaza coverage, Akbar received a Writers Guild Award and a New York Press Club Award and has twice been named a finalist for the Livingston Award. He previously covered foreign policy at HuffPost for 12 years. Hi, Akbar. Thank you so much for joining us and congratulations on your new job at Not Us.
Thank you so much, Rose.
You know, in the last segment, we were talking about just the changing media landscape. So for people who are not familiar with Not Us, can you tell us about it? And is that how you say it, Not Us?
I appreciate the opportunity to give a plug. I will say it is Notus, not Us. So,
okay,
you know, like SCOTUS or POTUS. So it stands for News of the United States. We will have a new name soon. I can't reveal what it is, but it will be out this fall, and we're really excited. Notus is a collection of some of the most experienced journalists in Washington, D.C. We've been brought together by Robert Allbritton, who founded Politico quite successfully, and now this is his new endeavor. And he really wanted to start this expansion, Rose, earlier this year, because of Jeff Bezos's destruction of the Washington Post, right? So at that point, there were so many talented reporters and editors without a home. Allbritton sort of looked at that and said, well, let's build a new newsroom out of this. So he hired up a lot of those good folks, brought in people from, me from HuffPost, other people from CNN, NBC, other outlets. And yeah, I'm on month three, and it's been quite good. It's really nice to be in this media environment where we are under assault, as you discussed, not only from the highest levels of government, but also from corporations, from media owners who are cutting off jobs instead of investing in accountability journalism. It's really inspiring and motivating to be at a newsroom that is actually lucky enough to be growing right now.
Well, that's great to hear. It's so needed. And you're covering U.S. foreign policy for Notus. There's so much going on right now, Akbar. The latest is that so many media outlets are running with the announcement that Trump made to disarm Gaza. And yet when you listen to these reports, you hear that there's a lot of uncertainty. What does this actually mean? And yet the media are running with this. So when Trump makes an announcement like this, how do you cover it?
It's unfortunate that, in the 11 years since Trump became really a dominant national political figure, media outlets haven't gotten past the habit of letting Trump be our assignment editor often. And I'm hopeful that more colleagues will kind of step up and be more critical and analytical towards White House statements. So certainly the statement that you're talking about this disarmament, this future of Gaza plan, President Trump is making a lot of big promises, right, about how Hamas, the Palestinian militant group in Hamas in Gaza that previously governed the Strip, is going to behave. This is a group that has had armed militancy as part of its core going back more than 30 years. So to imagine President Trump right now forcing a huge turnaround from them is kind of difficult. We also haven't seen the Israeli government confirm that Trump's plan is actually going to be implemented. So while it's important to cover these commitments, and they certainly tell us something about how Trump wants to be perceived as this kind of world mover, as someone who, ironically, sometimes since he has escalated wars so often, but as someone who does pitch himself as a peace president, it tells us he wants to be seen as having progress on Gaza and for the 2 million people there who remain in extremely dire humanitarian conditions, the vast majority of them unhoused, in tents, and in less than half of Gaza's actual territory. Progress couldn't come soon enough, but as we cover the Trump administration, it's so much about implementation. And is, are announcements like this about the president's ego, or are they actually going to lead to change?
And that's what makes this difficult, because obviously you cannot ignore what this man says. but he shapes the narrative for, you know, at least a few hours to a day, and then things rapidly change. I mean, the same thing is happening with the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. What are your thoughts about what we are hearing, the rhetoric coming from this administration? You have so many sources inside the government, and what is actually happening on the ground?
So what we hear from the administration is often countervailing messages, both on Iran and on Gaza. And you know, important to remember, both of these obviously so implicate the U.S. relationship with Israel, right? The war on Iran was launched in collaboration with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The assault on Gaza since October 2023, which is a bipartisan policy Trump has continued, is again U.S. backing of Israel. So when I'm talking to government sources, often I'm really talking to them about how do you handle the Israelis, you know, and what do you want from them? And are you going to cut off military support or apply pressure in other ways, rhetorically, or by refusing to kind of take steps that the Israelis might want? There are forces in the administration, Rose, who understand that the Iran war in particular has become a quagmire for President Trump. There's not a beneficial way out that produces either a clear positive for the US or even achieves Trump's stated goals, right, of regime change in Iran, of addressing its nuclear program. There is an acknowledgement within the government quietly that that is not going to happen. The question is, what kind of almost face-saving step can they move Trump towards? Important to remember, this is not driven by any necessary human concern about the 80 plus million Iranians who are living in fear right now. You know, there are constant U.S. strikes on parts of Iran with, again, no clear strategic objective. What I hear from officials is they're trying to persuade Trump to agree to some sort of deal with the Iranians over what's become the central flashpoint, the Strait of Hormuz, that strategic waterway through which a lot of the world's energy flows, and which has kind of been the heart of this new escalation between the U.S. and Iran. But the president's preferences consistently, and the people around him, the cabinet, often have enabled this. His preferences, and he's made this clear in business, he's made it clear in domestic policy, is to kind of be a bully. It's not about negotiation or diplomacy. It's about a zero-sum game. And that's where the challenge is for reconciling the administration's preference for a deal. How do you get a deal? Because the Iranians have shown they will want something in that deal too. And for them specifically, that is a recognition of their control over the Strait to an extent, which Trump is not seemingly willing to do. The administration is in a bind. Yeah.
It was incredible to read that one of your sources said, well, they told you this, the best hope for de-escalation is Trump being super distracted by beautifying the district, nodding to Trump's fixation on design choices around Washington. I mean, that was incredible to read. The likeliest outcome, they said, is pointless escalation. The second source said many cabinet members and military leaders have failed to be frank with Trump about the risks of launching his war on Iran in partnership with Israel, where officials have urged an assertive approach over diplomacy. Both sources expressed frustration with Brad Cooper, U.S. Central Command's current chief, with one saying he could be the driving force behind added but likely futile American attacks. You report that Brad Cooper could be pushing for a major attack on Iran.
There are certainly voices within the administration who continue to push for that major attack. We have to put this in the context of the U.S. struggling to adopt any policy towards Iran that is not fundamentally about military or economic pressure or coercion. And consistently, that hasn't gotten the results from Iran that the U.S. wants. So if you go back to 1979 and the kind of long history of the U.S. struggling to deal with the Islamic Republic since its founding, where we've seen some minimal progress, it's been in reducing tensions. So in the Obama era, or even in the 90s, when the Saudis, the Americans' closest partner in the region, and the Iranians were able to kind of ratchet down their tensions, getting President Trump to do that and to commit to it is a big ask. And then institutionally, within the US government, when you think about people like Admiral Cooper, who's running the US forces in the Middle East, or Chairman Kane of the Joint Chiefs, they've come up in a military doctrine that is very focused on pressure on Iran. And to some degree, there are bases for this. Of course, Iran has been opposed to US presence in the Middle East for a long time, and there's a lot of resentment among American troops for Iran-backed attacks on American forces in Iraq. But often that hasn't been linked to any political or diplomatic strategy. And in the Trump administration, where people are talking about specific uniformed officers who are very influential over the president, notice that we're not talking about any professional diplomats, any professional experts on Iran who do exist within the government. That it's not that there aren't people who really get how to deal with the Iranians. They're just not being asked into the Oval Office. Instead, you have, again, these people sort of with a more military background who, as some experts in Washington put it, if you constantly have a hammer, you think everything is a nail. The military under Trump is looking at a $1.5 trillion budget. And then you have people like Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, right, whose primary interests seem to be business and loyalty to Trump rather than any long-term US strategic gain. And let's not forget, Rose, that the Iranians are entirely capable of reading US news reports, of understanding these dynamics themselves, right? And so the increasing kind of analysis from Iran experts is that the Iranians may be throwing in the towel on any hope of any diplomacy in Iran, in Trump's presidency, and essentially saying maybe we just have to continue a low-level war for the next 2 to 3 years.
Akbar, what about ongoing control of the Strait of Hormuz?
So the hope among regional players is what's quite interesting here. There are US-aligned Arab states that are also adjacent to Hormuz and have relations with the Iranians, most importantly, Oman. They're leading negotiations, but for any kind of accord, any kind of deal to be set, it can't be that Trump says, "I've denied the Iranians all control of Hormuz." And it's interesting too, because you see Trump sometimes be open to the idea that some conciliatory steps towards the Iranians are important, or that he might treat them differently than past American presidents have. This was really interesting in June when he talked about ballistic missiles. It's long been a bipartisan and very much an Israeli-backed position that Iran cannot be allowed to have ballistic missiles. And it was actually President Trump who said, "Well, if we're okay with the Saudis and others in the region having them, maybe Iran should have them too." So those kind of competing impulses are there. It's really hard to sign an accord or a deal that the Iranians would want, something formal and something bound, measurable, with someone like Trump, whose impulses do change day to day. You saw this too with another aspect of this dynamic. And I know there's just so many countries and so many angles of this, but so much of it boils down to the unpredictability of Trump. You saw this with Trump announcing a major US nuclear deal with Saudi Arabia, and then very quickly adding on a requirement around Israel and the Saudis recognizing Israel, presumably someone, either from the Israeli government or kind of pro-Israel donors close to him, got him to do that. So for the Iranians, if you're thinking about Hormuz or any kind of accord, who's to say Trump doesn't add a new layer out of the blue?
And Akbar, what's so devastating about the coverage also, and we did a lot of shows about this earlier this year, about the Iranian regime shutting down all communications in Iran. And so that's why we're not hearing from Iranians. It's very hard to actually hear someone talking about what's happening because people are afraid of speaking out. In fact, Amnesty International just put out a piece a couple of days ago about the public execution of two protesters following the arbitrary execution of at least three other protesters last week. This marks a further escalation in the authorities' use of the death penalty to quash dissent. The organization fears that at least 60 others, including three arrested as children, remain at risk of execution after being sentenced to death. So there's that. And then The Guardian had a piece on Tuesday. Prisoners at Iran's largest jail, Soleipsi. I mean, this is so lips shut in hunger strike as executions soar. At least 1,500 protest after six men on drug-related charges are put in solitary confinement before possible execution. I mean, people are sewing their lips shut as hundreds join a mass hunger strike. We talk about how the human toll of war does not get the attention it deserves, but what the people in Iran are going through is definitely not getting the attention it deserves.
Absolutely. And it was predictable, Rose. I mean, just like the costs of this war, the economic costs on the global economy, the costs to Americans were predictable, and the fact that it was never going to be straightforward or easy. I remember talking earlier this year to advocates for some of the jailed activists and also American citizens in Iranian prisons. And this was a fear they were already bringing up then, that executions could rise, that if the regime were to splinter, crumble, feel under more pressure, its response would be to crack down more harshly on its own people. And it really has this heartbreaking irony, given that President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, when they launched this war, were talking about doing it on behalf of the Iranian people, right? And you haven't seen any kind of benefit for Iranians, certainly not within Iran. And you've seen in the Iranian diaspora, where some people were supportive of the military campaign, a lot of remorse, regret, a sense of betrayal. And we're absolutely not hearing as much as we should from within Iran. Some of the folks I have been able to talk to in recent months have talked about a sort of longer term trauma. So, of course, there's a daily fear and danger about the regime, about US or Israeli strikes that seem possible to escalate at any time, but also about the years lost, right? And the traumas that are setting in. These are, again, echoes very clearly of Gaza and of Palestinians and of a US national security establishment that hasn't taken lessons from what it was implicated just a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. right? So the people who I am able to talk to are just emphasizing the daily struggle to survive and to abandon sort of dreams and hopes for their futures. Again, with a regime that is fractured, more hardline, more bitter and more resentful than it was before February 28th.
Exactly, Akbar. And we don't have that much time to talk about this, but we'll do another show. Because of that, because the United States, Trump, Israel is bombing Iran, some in the alternative media are really giving the Iranian regime a pass. It's almost like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's such a something that has happened many, many times in this country, unfortunately.
It's a really unfortunate cynicism. You saw this too in some who spoke up in defense and support of Syrian dictator Bashar Assad as right. he was slaughtering his own people en masse, arresting them en masse, subjecting them to torture, and intensifying what was very clearly a decades-long oppressive regime. I think in this moment of scrambling for narratives and for making sense of these really earth-shattering kind of decisions, people are reaching. What it speaks to me, Rose, is the broader sense of foreign policy not being democratized, not being in the hands of everyday people. And so they're kind of reaching for whatever explanations, positions might make sense in the moment rather than a more positive, broader agenda.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed covers U.S. Foreign policy for Notice, News of the United States. We are almost out of time. We do not have time to play these clips of now the late Senator Lindsey Graham. He was taking part in a documentary with Alex Holder. CNN and the Wall Street Journal got hands on some of the footage, and we can hear Lindsey Graham laughing about Trump bombing Iran, and you can find that online. I do want to spend our remaining time talking about Netanyahu's visit to the U.S., and I want to play two clips. Netanyahu sat down for a 15-minute interview with ABC News's Lindsay Davis. She asked him what he thinks of U.S. support for the current Israeli government dropping in the United States, and he blamed it on social media lies.
But doesn't it go beyond social media? Because you have genocide scholars, you have humanitarian groups, the United Nations, who have all said that Israel has committed war crimes. So would you say that you bear any responsibility?
Not for war crimes. I think that's hogwash. I mean, what they say genocide, right? Okay. Well, first of all, who says genocide? The the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court who came up with this. Genocide is the attempt to wipe out a people, the actual attempt and plan to wipe out a people, and the actual action that you do. In Gaza, they accuse us of genocide. We sent millions of text messages and millions of phone calls and millions of leaflets telling Palestinians, civilians, get out of harm's way so that we can take out the Hamas terrorists who are embedded in your schools, your hospitals, your communities. Hamas stopped the civilians from leaving at gunpoint. Clearly, and that's how we got civilian casualties that eventually went down, I'm happy to say.
And that's
why did
we... ABC News' Lindsay Davis, and I'm so glad, finally, I've been wanting a national reporter to ask him this. Okay, if you think that there's lies, why not allow journalists into Gaza, independent of Israeli forces?
Yeah, we do, I think, sometimes. But the problem there is it's a war zone. Still, rockets are flying, mines are exploding. There are terror tunnels out of which terrorists emerge. And what do you do when journalists get killed? But I think people, you know, you can see what's happening. We don't hide it. I mean, anybody can use a Google map.
So that's Netanyahu talking with ABC News' Lindsay Davis. We're almost out of time, Akbar. I mean, it was really incredible to hear him say, you know, I think we do. No journalist has been allowed in. She really didn't push back in this 15-minute interview. I don't understand why she cannot say the number of Palestinians that have been killed, over 73,000. 175,000 wounded. Gaza hosts now, well, it's an awful word I'm reading from the UN. Gaza has the largest group of child amputees in modern history. She never said any of that in this interview. What do you think explains this?
But it's the ease with which these kinds of losses, this very real human suffering, is isolated from any responsibility and is made to seem inevitable, right? And I think that's why my reporting, particularly in my book on the Biden administration crossing the red line, but also in talking about Trump, there are so many avoidable deaths that US officials, Israeli officials are implicated in. But when you hear Netanyahu speak, it's a very easy clip to give to a reporter to say, well, journalists get killed. Who is doing the killing there, right? We have data that journalists have been targeted by Israeli forces repeatedly. In fact, often the IDF has publicly said, well, we believe this journalist was a Hamas operative and then has not been able to provide evidence. The deference that I think a lot of people in US media still give to these Israeli claims more than 3 years into this unbelievably horrifying war is unsustainable, and I think will long be seen as a stain, frankly, on our entire industry.
And DropSite reports that Israel is paying millions to train AI chatbots how to talk about Gaza. Former Trump campaign manager Brad Parscale is overseeing an operation posting hundreds of blog posts on behalf of Israel and the Netanyahu government with the goal of infiltrating AI. Akbar, final thoughts on that? We have about 30 seconds.
There's a real push on the right to kind of counter what is a dramatic drop in Israel's support. But I think what's so clear in that Netanyahu clip that spoke to it is Israel's defenders are still not drawing the link between Israel's actual own actions and why people are opposing it, right? So they're casting it as anti-Semitism, lack of information, lack of support, lack of positive messaging, rather than the willingness to just look at the actual policies in Gaza, Lebanon, Iran, and beyond.
And people are responding to, you know, several years of just seeing absolute destruction on our phones and the killing of fathers, mothers, children, buildings, the infrastructure. People saw it. We saw it with our own eyes.
And in some cases, you know, Palestinians, as they say, you know, were, in other words, live streaming their own genocide. They were shocked and appalled that the world wasn't willing to respond in those ways. And important to remember, even since Trump has said a ceasefire has set in, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed since last October.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed covers U.S. foreign policy for Notus, N-O-T-U-S. Thank you so much, Akbar. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Thank you.